What do we really know about the health benefits and drawbacks of marijuana? Medical marijuana is now legal in 28 states in the District of Columbia. Marijuana is now legal for recreational use in Maine, D.C., and 7 other states. And it's estimated that more than 22 million Americans have used it in the past 30 days. Proponents see it as a valuable treatment for many people, including cancer patients, those with chronic pain, and as a stress reliever. Others worry about the impact of marijuana on public health, especially teenagers with developing brains and people who might drive after using. Who's right? Well, just last month, the National Academy of Sciences released a review of the most up-to-date research on marijuana. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will discuss that report and the existing research with doctors and scientists looking hard at the impact of marijuana. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Maine's new law allowing recreational use of marijuana just kicked in last week. Similar laws are now in place in 7 other states and in Washington, D.C. But in all the debate over the laws, how much do we know about the science side of things? What exactly does cannabis do or not do? And what about its effectiveness as a medical treatment? Research on the physiological and cognitive effects of marijuana is limited. We'll learn what the science says, what we know so far. In the studio with me, Christian Teeter. He is an associate professor of psychopharmacology with the University of New England's College of Pharmacy. And Dr. Jonathan Fellers. He's the director of the Integrated Medication-Assisted Treatment Program at Maine Medical Center. As always, we want to hear from you. What do you think of marijuana? Do you think it helps or harms? Do you think that the medical benefits outweigh the risk? Do you have questions for our panel? Our phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling. Post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thanks to both of you for being here today. Christian, you do presentations at schools on the topic of marijuana and what it does to you. What are the main points that you try to get across to young people?
Probably the main points are that we're using it medically for a variety of conditions in adults, but that data can't be unequivocally the safety of that data or the efficacy of that data can't just be translated or moved over to children and adolescents because their brain is still developing. So the main point is we try to go in and say, you hear all this stuff about medical marijuana, therefore your perceived risk drops because you think it's a medical, therefore safe option. But a lot of that data, even the latest National Academy of Science and Engineering and Medicine, their report even said, hey, listen, all this data that we just reviewed, which I'm sure we'll get into today, it doesn't all translate to the developing brain. So that's the message we're trying to get is you can't just assume it's safe because adults are using it because your brain's still developing.
Okay. Jonathan, I want to ask you, he mentioned the National Academies of Sciences report. It just came out. How much research is out there? How much was it able? I know the people who wrote this report looked at everything they could find, and they still kind of said, there's a lot we don't know, right?
Absolutely true. One of the challenges with medical marijuana is that marijuana is still a Schedule I substance from the DEA's perspective.
Can I stop and ask
Sure.
you what that means, Schedule I?
So Schedule I is defined as something with high abuse potential and no approved medical indications. And so that also includes other drugs like heroin, LSD, ecstasy, MDMA, and cannabis, marijuana is also included there. Now, we do have other drugs that are Schedule II, and those are drugs that we also recognize have a high abuse potential, but they also have an approved use, and we know that they're helpful for a lot of medical conditions. So that's where a lot of the opiate painkillers reside, so oxycodone, morphine. They're Schedule II substances, as well as some of the medications we use for ADHD, like Adderall, amphetamines, things like that.
So because marijuana is Schedule I, does that mean it's really hard for researchers to get funding on trying to find out what kind of medicinal benefits there might be, since it's, by law, has none?
Yes. So it's a lot harder to do research on Schedule I substances because there's a lot tighter regulations on who can do such research, where you can even source the material to do it. And in marijuana's case, there's only one source that's allowed to use cannabis. And it used to be a farm in Georgia where they would grow marijuana for the national dispensary. And it was anecdotally known as very poor weed, like very poor quality. And so because of that, because of the regulatory hurdles for studying a Schedule I substance, as well as, our own government's kind of hesitancy to really explore a medicinal use for it, it's been very challenging to do any research studies with it.
Are we learning now that we know that Colorado was the first state to legalize marijuana for recreational uses? Are we learning anything from the experience of Colorado, or has it not been enough time yet?
It's probably too early. There is some studies coming out of the Colorado experience. And, you know, our state, with just passing the regulations, we're also at a good place to kind of take a look at this exact question. But they've really tried to look to see if after passing recreational legislation, whether young people are using more cannabis as a consequence of that. And the reports that are out have not shown that that's to be true. However, you have to take it with a grain of salt, because they're also the states that have passed recreational laws do seem to be a little different than states that haven't passed recreational laws by the makeup. So they, before they even passed the legislation, it was a more permissive atmosphere towards cannabis in general. And then there has been some studies that show that some unintended consequences of the legislation have come about. So, for example, pediatric exposures to cannabis in emergency room visits has gone up in those states that have passed recreational marijuana.
So young children may be eating a brownie or a gummy or something like that.
Yeah, inadvertently, being exposed, not knowing. And, you know, I do worry about that, because if you've seen the edibles, they are sometimes very difficult to tell if that's actually, an edible marijuana product or just a candy or something else, because they look very similar.
Kristen Teeter, I want to back up and have you explain to us, how does cannabis affect the brain? How does it work?
So you have cannabinoid 1 receptors in your brain, and it's kind of thought that they kind of act as a brake. You know, so some of the transmitters in your brain are kind of what we call inhibitory. Other ones are excitatory. And so to use 2 transmitters as an example, the cannabinoids would be considered kind of a brake, and glutamate would be kind of considered an excitatory neurotransmitter. So let's say the thought is that as these cells are communicating, that the cannabinoid 1 receptors would be there in the synapse to basically quiet down and stabilize the neuron so that they don't fire. So what that would mean, for example, if you're the common thought is that if you are trying to learn something new, you form memories in your hippocampus and your higher cortex. And glutamate's part of that process, like long-term potentiation, these types of boring words. But the glutamate is there to help you form memories. Cannabis, by being a kind of inhibitory system, it can suppress glutamate. And therefore, that's why the thought is you can't learn new memories while you're acutely high on marijuana, because you're inhibiting possibly the formation of memories in the first place.
All right. So the movie stereotype of somebody who's stoned on marijuana and is dumb because of it is got some physiological basis.
Yeah. So if you look at that report, and I've went through that report 100 times because I wanted to make sure we were giving clear messages to high school students, which we'll come back to in a little bit. But one of the things that it's hard to argue against the fact that acutely, while you're actively high on marijuana, your ability to form new memories is diminished. And part of that's probably because cannabis is there to, or cannabinoid receptors and anandamide, these endogenous cannabinoids, are there to kind of act as brakes. And acting as the brakes in hippocampus while you're forming memories is a bad thing.
All right. Joining me on the line right now, Dr. Vijay Amarendran. He's an addiction psychiatrist, and he's the medical director of outpatient services at Acadia Hospital. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You treat patients who are addicted to opioids, which we all know is a terrible problem here in Maine. How addictive is marijuana in comparison, and can a marijuana addiction be treated?
So marijuana, contrary to popular belief, marijuana does have an addiction potential. I think the perception of marijuana as not addictive or not harmful has gradually increased in the community. But now we know that there is about an 8 to 10% risk of addiction with chronic use of marijuana. The risk is higher if you start smoking cannabis at an earlier age. So teenagers are at higher risk for becoming addicted later on to cannabis.
Can you explain the process a drug normally goes through before it's approved for medicinal use? And why is that not applied to marijuana?
Why is it not applied to marijuana? I can't answer that, but typically, if a new compound has been studied in animals and shown to be effective for a medical condition, the FDA and the drug companies, say, for example, goes through a phase one trial. They give it to a small group of normal subjects to see what is the effect of this medication on normal subjects. What's the safe limit of this medication? Phase two trials, where you look at a larger group of people and see what are the conditions it's helpful for and what are the side effects. And then phase three trials, where you compare the medication with an active or active treatment or with an inactive placebo to see how it stacks up against current treatments or against placebo. And then phase four trials, after the marketing, you continue to study the safety effects, long-term safety effects of a medication. Cannabis, with marijuana, we never did any of these studies, and we just started legislating our way into using it as a medicine. There have been some studies, like with phase three trials with chronic pain and multiple sclerosis and spasticity associated with multiple sclerosis, but definitely not the rigorous trials that any other medication would go through. The dosing of medical marijuana is also not quite clear. If a medical doctor recommends medical marijuana, after that the patient goes to a dispensary and buys whatever they want to do and doses it according to their needs. So there's no strict control. Like, it's not like Prozac 20 milligrams. It's like smoke this much amount of cannabis, and there's no real control over how much somebody smokes and whether there is a dose-response relationship. There's a lot of questions that come up when you think about using marijuana as a medicine.
Well, Dr. Vijay Amarendran, thank you so much for joining us. Dr. Amarendran is the medical director of outpatient services at Acadia Hospital. You know, Dr. Amarendran was talking about dosing and how difficult it is. Isn't part of the reason it's difficult is every strain of marijuana is different, and depending even what soil the plant was grown in, the same strain can be different in two cases.
So this is another one of those messages, no matter who I'm speaking to, it's hard to argue against this fact that there are 60-something cannabinoids that we're well aware of in cannabis plant. You take the opioid, you take the poppy plant, for example, you're talking two or three. You're talking basically morphine and codeine. In the cannabis plant, you're talking about plus 60. So that's 60 different cannabinoids, and a lot of the activity does come from a minority of the cannabinoids, cannabidiol and THC, Delta-9 THC, but there are still a bunch of other cannabinoids that are involved in the cannabis plant, and we're getting better at teasing apart, well, is cannabidiol, for example, better for this symptom, and THC better for this symptom, things like of that nature. But really, you're talking about a whole bunch of cannabinoids in the cannabis plant without a really good idea of which cannabinoid can be correlated, can be associated with what symptom relief.
Dr. Fellers, what do you think of the medicinal effectiveness of marijuana for symptoms such as nausea, seizures, chronic pain?
Well, it's a great question, because that's what's written into the legislation already for medical marijuana. And we do have pretty good evidence for THC, which is Marinol. And so there's actually two cannabinoids that are already approved for medical use and have gone through those different stages of clinical trials that former speaker was talking about. And so we do know that the cannabinoids Delta-9 THC in particular, is helpful for nausea and antiemetic properties needed for like post-cancer treatment or HIV/AIDS wasting syndrome. The research that takes a look at it, it's kind of interesting because it's not shown to be necessarily more effective than already available medications, but the patients liked it more than the other options. So we have that tells you a little something about it, I think.
I thought you were going to jump in, Christian.
I was just agreeing with them. I mean, because pain, part of pain is the affective state. It's not just the physical symptoms. It's the affective state. And I think the fact that it makes you feel good is definitely part of the story.
Well, what about people who in general say, I'd rather take something that is natural, that is grown in the earth, than something that's concocted in a lab?
I had a bipolar patient once tell me that they smoked marijuana for their bipolar because it's natural. And I said, well, lithium's an element. Right. So there are, and what I mean by that, there are a lot of natural products, aspirin, these other things that people don't want to take because it's a medicine, yet they're natural. So I don't really buy that theory, again, because lithium, again, being an element, it's in nature, but they don't want to take that because it's a medicine.
Well, we do have a lot of natural medications available, and there's also a lot of dangerous natural things out there, too. Belladonna, we had used in medicine for a long time, like digoxin, foxglove. There's a lot of poisons out there as well, and really the only difference between a poison and a medication is proper dosing and the use and the indication for what you're using it. Something that could be helpful can also be very harmful too. And it's a lot related to the dose. So I do understand this idea of wanting to take all natural substances, but until we really understand if it's helpful or not, I don't think it's always the best way of going.
Kristen Teeter, what is your recommendation to a patient or a friend or a family member when it comes to marijuana use?
What is my recommendation?
If a friend of yours says, so give me the broad picture. So is this okay?
Yeah, so basically my position on this it's kind of gray. So if your brain's still developing, which could be anywhere up from the literature says 24 to 25, so any age up to about 24 or 25, it's a pretty easy question for me. I'm like, I would be saying to this person, the earlier that you smoke and the more frequent that you smoke, the more you're risking putting yourself at risk for these things down the road. Like in that National Academies report, you know, it's frequent use as an adolescent predicted later psychotic symptoms or schizophrenia, right? So these types of things. You're putting yourself at risk. Dependence. We know that cannabis dependence is increased the earlier you use it and the more frequent your use is. So before age 24, 25, it's very easy for me. Delay use as much as you possibly can and use it as infrequently as possible. Now, as an adult, it's harder to say because I'm not afraid of cannabinoids in the adult brain because it's like alcohol. It goes back to the dosing issue. I can take alcohol or you could take cannabinoids. And if you dose them moderately, in moderation, alcohol, it's easy to kind of dose moderation because we all know what a standard drink is in general, right? You have your 1.5 ounces of liquor, your 5 ounces of wine, 12 ounces of a 5% beer. You can standardize that. You can correlate it to blood levels. Moderation's very easy. So going back to the dose, as the doctor said, marijuana, if you can keep it in moderation, which is we can't define yet, but I would tell my adults, whatever moderation is to you, where you kind of have to guess a little bit more with marijuana because there aren't clear thresholds, I would say use moderately, whatever that is to you. When you start making decisions based on marijuana, you've probably gotten out of the moderate realm.
I just want to add the point that the question is kind of interesting because your views on it recreationally is a lot different than my views on it medically. If we're calling it a medicine, we really are hoping that it has a medical therapeutic value. If you're calling it recreational, that's a different story altogether. And I think it's a fine line, but it's part of our answering as well.
All right. Well, we do have to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does the Orthopedic Institute of Central Maine, providing joint replacement, spine surgery, and hip fracture care, jointsme.org.
Maine Governor Paul LePage gives his State of the State address Tuesday evening, and Maine Public will be there. Tune into Maine Public Television or Maine Public Radio Tuesday evening at 7 for live coverage of the governor's speech and the Democratic response. The State of the State, Tuesday evening at 7 on Maine Public Radio and Television, with a rebroadcast Wednesday afternoon on Maine Public Radio.
Hello, I'm Mandalit Del Barco from NPR News. As a listener of Maine Public Radio, you understand that public radio is very different from any other media. Our values are to focus on the qualities of mind, heart, and craft, not ratings and profit margins. We dare to examine the issues, provide comprehensive analysis, and examine topics in the way that few other broadcast outlets can. Your financial commitment to us provides the means to adhere to the highest journal and production standards and to push ourselves to do even better. Your contribution makes a difference. It helps keep public radio values on the air. Please call with your gift today or give online, and when you do, your gift will be counted toward the Super Thursday one-day membership drive. Thanks.
And Super Thursday is this Thursday, February 9th, but you can contribute right now at mainpublic.org or by calling 1-800-866-1475. Thanks.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the science on the health effects of marijuana. In the studio with me, Jonathan Fellers, who is an addiction psychiatrist with Maine Medical Center, and Christian Teeter with the University of New England's College of Pharmacy. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We have another doctor joining us on the line right now, Dr. James Lee, an emergency physician based in Damariscotta, former assistant professor of medicine at Harvard Medical Center. Dr. Lee, thanks for joining us. One area where there has been research in the use of marijuana is to treat pain, especially acute pain. Have you seen evidence of this working?
Hi, Jennifer, and thanks for inviting me on your show. It's been a great panel so far, and hi to Christian and John there, too. I want to say something first. The main concern that I hear reflected on the show is that younger people will get a hold of marijuana, and I want to echo that concern. We're talking about recreational marijuana, not medicinal marijuana, but even in states that have only medical programs, physicians generally are concerned that if there is increased access, that the high school population, the younger age population will have more access to. And we've actually seen that in many different studies. Marijuana happens to be one of the most, the largest substance abuse problem with alcohol in the high school age set in Maine. And with the recreational law, I echo the concerns about cognitive development and problem cannabis use and dependency. Those are real issues, and that is, I think, a real objective proved harm of marijuana. But getting back to your question about pain, there really is no evidence in the medical research that deals with acute pain, even though we see it, at least I see it in a practice that I have with medical marijuana patients who have pain from things like migraines and other things that come on suddenly that are effectively treated. But the research isn't there, and part of the problem has to do with this Schedule I restriction on research. So it's not because the research has been done and shows that there's no effect. It's just that there's just not that much research available because of the limitations in being able to do it.
So you have anecdotal evidence, but not studies to back up the anecdotal evidence.
Yes, but we're talking about acute pain, which is the kind of pain that you have that's short-term. If you break a leg or if you have appendicitis or if you go in for surgery, that's called acute pain. Chronic pain, which is pain that's long-standing that you've had over and over and over for a long time, has indeed been well studied. The National Academy of Sciences put out this, I just have to say, it's a great report. We've all been waiting for a study like this. It was commissioned by multiple federal agencies. It's got a blue ribbon committee of over 30 researchers from places like Johns Hopkins and Harvard, and they really did a fine job of looking at the literature, and they concluded, based on the review, and it mirrors my own reading of the literature, that there is conclusive evidence that cannabis, in a variety of different forms, is effective for treating chronic pain. And I'll tell you, anecdotally, in my own practice, I entered this whole arena as a skeptic. I did not think marijuana had any medical benefits. I was on board with a Schedule I rating, but having treated now hundreds of chronic pain patients who, in the hospital setting, I couldn't treat. These are patients that are on half a dozen or even a dozen different types of prescription medicines without substantial relief. And I got to say, it was really an eye-opener to me when the first patient started coming back and we could wean them off of all their other medicines because the marijuana itself was effective for their pain in a way that nothing else had been. And that's substantiated in the literature, and it's something that's an important message to get out.
So do you believe that marijuana in many cases is a better choice than opioids, which we're seeing so many problems with?
That's a tough question. The simple answer is yes, but there are a lot of variables. Marijuana does have an abuse potential, and there is a term that we use called problem marijuana use, which we see in people who use it more frequently, who are younger. If you're a male and you're a smoker, you're at higher risk for this problem cannabis use, which is basically another way of saying you can become dependent or addicted to it. The big difference, though, is that opiates kill people. We've seen that in repeated studies. The CDC has been banging the drum now for about 5 years.
Sure, overdose deaths, yeah.
Right. Every 30 minutes, somebody in the United States dies of an unintended, non-suicide opiate overdose from prescription opiate. Mostly these are people that are using their opiates the way they were prescribed to be used. And you don't see that with marijuana. So if you're just looking from a purely life and death standpoint, marijuana certainly is safer than opioids. The danger is if everybody uses marijuana, then we're going to have a lot more problem cannabis users, maybe even more than problem opiate users. So you're substituting one potentially addicting substance for another. But overall, in my own mind, it's still safer because you just don't see the death from marijuana that you do from opiates.
Well, Dr. Lee, thank you so much for joining us. Dr. James Lee, an emergency physician based in Damariscotta. We're going to go to audience calls now. We'll start with Ron, who's calling from Harmony. Hi, Ron. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Yes. Hi, Jen. Thanks for taking the call. Again, I'm a retired resident of Harmony here a long time, and I'm also a glaucoma patient. I've been legally blind now since 2011. In 2012, I was determined disabled, but I wanted to keep on working. That's the main gene. And by 2014, I just got to the point that I had to retire. However, by that time, I had been through a total of, I believe, 12 operations involving anesthesia and stitches in my eyes. I had had multiple laser procedures done on my eyes, and I was using and had been for 5 years prior to my retirement approximately $1,000 to $1,200 worth of drops, Western medication drops, in my eyes to keep the pressures down in my eyes. This had gone on for 5 years. When I retired in 2014, I still had IOPs, intraocular pressures, of 36 in one eye and 47 in the other, despite all of these procedures that had been going on and all of the dreaded expense that my insurance company and I had both gone through. At that time, when I retired, a young friend of mine actually presented me, who was virtually a marijuana virgin, with a small vial of a tincture, marijuana tincture, and said, "Ron, maybe this would help you. You really need to keep your eyesight." And it was about a week before I was about to have my IOPs tested. And I remember my IOPs had been at 36 and 47. After a week of using this tincture, which is taken under the tongue and doesn't cause me to get high, when I had my eyes tested, they tested 22 and 23.
Wow. Ron, I want to give our guests, our panel, a chance to respond. Have you heard about medical use for glaucoma?
Yeah, the evidence at large doesn't support an overwhelming large effect for glaucoma. But I think, you know, you have to step back for a minute in terms of when you ask if something's efficacious. Marijuana definitely has efficacy, or has demonstrated efficacy, for a variety of conditions. However, the current state of medical marijuana would be, the analogy would be, I'm going to give you a prescription for opioids. Go take opioids until your glaucoma goes away. Go take opioids until your pain goes away. And it's all self-titrated. It's self-titrated us in. So at least speaking for myself, I'm not here to say that it is or isn't efficacious. I'm here to say you can't just let a patient self-titrate their medication, especially when it will be mixed with other medications.
But it works for Ron.
Mm-hmm. It worked, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So for glaucoma, there's pretty good evidence at the animal level. So that's very preliminary evidence that it can be helpful for glaucoma, but there haven't been human studies. But, you know, I think, you know, Ron has a very good example of how medical marijuana can be effective for a specific situation. But just because it's effective in Ron's scenario doesn't mean it's effective for everybody out there who has glaucoma.
All right. Well, Ron, go ahead.
And so we call these like anecdotal reports or case reports. And we publish on this stuff a lot, actually, in medicine, about a case report of trying something in another way. And it can give ideas and directions of where we should look for things. But we don't say it has like that evidence backing or the trust that we should do this for everybody. And it's kind of like a slot machine. If it pays off once, you're really going to remember like every time you go in that slot machine that you've got paid off once. But you'd forget about the times that it didn't work. And so I think there's a positive recall bias for things like this.
All right. Ron, thanks so much for calling and sharing your story. We're going to go to Renee, who writes in an email, have any other countries done extensive medical research on marijuana? Any research on the effects of smoking marijuana on the lungs?
Well, if you look at that National Academies report, they basically, there's good and bad news, right? So, and I, a couple of years ago, I had a couple of research interns, and we tore that literature apart. And there's even some things that are paradoxical, like forced lung capacity. Marijuana smokers have an increased forced lung capacity compared to non-smokers. Basically, what they think it is, it's a yoga effect, right? They're constantly taking deep breaths and hold it. If you were just sitting around and you took a deep breath and held it, well, that's what the authors attributed to, the researchers. But basically, you get all these mixed findings, good news and bad news. So the bad news would be increased like bronchitis type scenarios, but not increased risk in cancer from smoking, right? So you go into the lung literature and it's like a bittersweet, here's some good news, here's some bad news, but it's not as scary as you would be led to, that you would think on the surface, you know, oh, you smoke, therefore lung cancer. No, that's not the case with cannabinoids.
So for research of marijuana, like for smoked marijuana, it's a little hard. So other countries are doing research on cannabis. And, you know, Canada has quite a bit of robust literature on like another form of medical marijuana or a pharmaceutical grade. They call it like the mixed cannabinoid. So it contains both THC plus cannabidiol. It's called Sativex is the brand name for it. And so they've looked at those things, whereas we really haven't looked at those things at all. And so because of that legal backdrop, some countries are better able to study things. They're doing quite a bit of research in Israel, for example, taking a look at cannabis products for PTSD. That's probably not something that's being done here in the U.S. because of the regulatory.
Right, the VA can't prescribe it because it's illegal in federal law.
And we should go back to that for a minute. The Sativex is nabiximols, and that's THC and cannabidiol. That's an oral spray, and that's the kind of stuff that we need in the United States. Is you know exactly what the concentration is, and every single time you spray it, it's the same amount. Not going back to my self-titration method. Take whatever formulation you want until your pain goes away or your glaucoma gets better. Sativex is a controlled administered bottle, and it's a spray. It's not a smokable. So that's what we need here, are those kind of – and I wouldn't be surprised if we saw Sativax, and there are a few of them now that are kind of making their way in. And there's even a study here from – I think it's GW Pharma, where they're starting to look at those kind of minimal cannabinoid, isolated cannabinoid products.
When are we going to know? We're talking about the research in Israel, the research in Canada. When are we going to have a broader and more meaningful base of knowledge about this? Is it going to be next year, 5 years from now, 10 years from now?
Well, my area of interest, going back to the adolescent brain and what Dr. Lee had mentioned about kids getting a hold of it and having cognitive impairments, that whole piece of the story, there's a study right now that if anyone's interested in that piece of it, they should be following the ABCD study. It's the Adolescent Brain and Cognition Development, I think it is. It's an acronym for Adolescent Brain Cognition Development, I think. But it's a 10-year study going on right now where they're going to longitudinally follow 10,000 kids. So some of the other areas I can't speak to as well, but in terms of adolescent brain development and cannabinoids, which is my biggest concern with it, there is a study that we can all look for here at the United States to follow these kids, and they're going to get genetics, they're going to get brain imaging, and they're going to collect all the behavioral data.
You know, something that we – you know, another reason why we're not studying it to a greater extent is funding too. You know, I think we kind of talked about that to a little bit, but pharmaceutical companies are the ones who are really driving drug development to a large part, and you can't really patent marijuana. And so there's not much incentive to take a look for something that's been around a long time and study it in earnest. And then the government, the other way that we develop medications is through government grants. And it's government doesn't provide grant funding to study Schedule I substances in that way. They like to look at it for the abuse liability or the harmful effects way, not from the potential therapeutic avenue.
Well, we have to take another break. When we return, more of your comments and questions. Please stay with us.
You make May Calling possible, as does the Law Offices of Joe Bornstein, a statewide practice representing injured and disabled Mainers since 1974. JoeBornstein.com.
Hi, it's Mark Vogelsang, CEO of Maine Public. We're doing all we can to ensure that Maine Public Radio provides you with the best service we possibly can offer, a service that features our new lineup of NPR news shows and critical information. Today, there are more reasons than ever before to lend your support. More choice, more essential NPR journalism, more news programs. We're doing what we can to make Maine Public Radio live up to all that you want us to be. Listeners like you play a crucial role to keep this independent news service strong. So please stand up and be counted. You can do that on Super Thursday, our one-day membership campaign on February 9th. Whether it's joining me in becoming a sustaining monthly Evergreen supporter or becoming a new contributor, together we can do this and help pay for the news that we all care about. Of course, you can also pledge online right now, this second, and have it count toward our Super Thursday goals at mainpublic.org. Thanks.
And join us at 2 o'clock following Maine Calling for the Commonwealth Club of California. Today's speaker is Janet Yellen, Chair of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System. That's the Commonwealth Club of California, coming up after Maine Calling here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the research on marijuana and its effects on the body. In the studio with me, Christian Teeter, an associate professor of psychopharmacology at UNE. And Dr. Jonathan Fellers, director of the Integrated Medication-Assisted Treatment Program at Maine Med. If you'd like to give us a call, our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. We're going to go to Sue, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Sue. Go ahead.
Hi there. I would like to thank you for taking up this important topic. I only wish it had been discussed this thoroughly before the referendum in Maine. Your panel is bringing up some very important points, though I have not heard them mention something that is directly affecting our family. My 20-year-old son experienced a drug-induced psychosis this summer that was brought on by his use of cannabis. When he developed this episode, the psychotic episode of being paranoid schizophrenic, he was hospitalized and in rehab for 3 months, including at Spring Harbor. His providers indicated that cannabis was the primary motivator for his psychotic episode. The toxicology reports showed no other substance in his system, nor did he have any history of psychosis, or did we have it in our family. Happily, it dissipated over the course of several months. So now we know that it was really brought on by his use of cannabis. And providers also told us there's been a dramatic increase in the amount of cannabis-induced psychosis since the more prevalent use of recreational marijuana has been brought about.
Sue, thank you so much for your call, and I'm so glad your son is doing better. And both of our guests here were nodding during your story. This is not the first time you've heard a story like this.
Well,
go ahead.
Two quick things, then I'll let the psychiatrist handle this one. One is the potency of THC has been rising. We know that. Another one is the spice products that are sprayed with pure cannabinoid agonist. THC is actually a partial agonist. Pure cannabinoid agonists that also don't have cannabidiol, which is thought to actually protect from some of the psychosis. So that's one thing, is that the potencies are going higher. They're getting, you know, you're using pure cannabinoids. The other piece of that is I would encourage that mom, if she was interested in reading that National Academies Press, the data was, it was one of the few like where they could really say with certainty that you will increase, or you could increase, psychosis / schizophrenia risk with early onset. So it lines up with the data, and I'm not surprised given potencies.
Right. I was going to just echo that same comment. The cannabis that's now available isn't like you're from the day of the hippies, the kind of dirt weed people used to talk about. THC content is well above 10%, and it used to be 2%, really. So the more potent something is, the more effect it can have. And so the cannabis that's available now is a lot more potent. And it's been well established that cannabis, especially in vulnerable individuals, and I understand the caller, there was no family history. But when I talk to college students, talk to anybody about cannabis, especially if there is a family history of psychosis, like schizophrenia or even bipolar affective disorder, those people have a genetic vulnerability to that. And the use of cannabis has been shown to hasten the development of that, such that they will experience a psychotic episode earlier. Maybe even undercover something that might not have happened.
We have a related Facebook post from Christy. She says, when she's talking about schizophrenia, has it been proven to be causal, or might it be correlation? For example, perhaps people who are prone to develop schizophrenia might be more apt to try cannabis.
Well, I think it's actually – so the evidence is more than just an association at this point. But it is true that people who are prone to develop schizophrenia may seek out substances to kind of fit in or with a peer group or normalize their experience.
All right, Sue, thank you so much for your call. We're going to go to Jack in Unity. And Jack, I'm going to ask you and all the rest of our callers, because we have so many, if you could please tell your story briefly. Thank you.
You bet. Hi, thanks for having me on the show. I had a very severe accident. I'm an arborist, and I fell 60 feet from a tree. I broke 6 bones, 2 in the spine, 4 ribs. I collapsed the lung. I was on opioids for quite a while. I'm still in the midst of workers' comp and physical therapy and stuff like that. And I'm taking 7 different drugs, including anti-anxiety drugs. I had done recreational marijuana before, but this was the first time that I really started taking medical. And I buy my stuff at not a dispensary, but a caregiver. So it's East Coast CBDs here in Unity. And I can get CBDs that do not get me high in any way, and that help my pain, and actually I believe they help my mood. Of course, this is anecdotal, whatever you want to make of it. I still do the THC pot. It's really good for the kind of stuff I've had to do in the last 6 months. I had a concurrent case of cancer for which I got radiation. The blues, the burns, you know, all the stuff that I had, it was made easier with the THC. Gave me an appetite, stuff like that. I never got nauseous. And I will say, I'm also a musician. I know a lot of musicians who smoke, and this whole short-term memory thing, I would throw it out the window. We learn, a lot of us, better when we have had a toke. So for chronic pain, for music, you know, all those things. And one little tiny, you know, argument is that, you know, kids die every year in Maine and all over the U.S. finding alcohol, drinking antifreeze, and finding opioids. No child has died from a gummy bear with marijuana in it.
Okay, Jack, thanks so much for your call. And we have a related email from Robert. As a dedicated registered primary caregiver working with Maine's medical marijuana program, I've been surprised how differently individuals respond to the same cannabis strains. I've also gained a great deal of respect for the helpful healing qualities of cannabis, which are many. I've had patients literally force their gratitude on me, apparently compelled to drive home the point that the medicine I produce has a profoundly positive impact on their symptoms and their lives. So these stories are real.
Yeah, the stories are real. But anybody who would assert that there's no short-term memory impairment has not read any literature. And everybody sees what they want to see when they're doing things. But if you read the evidence, which means I take 1,000 people and put them in a room and get them, half of them high and the other half not high, the half that's not high is going to be able to recall digits, recall numbers. Maybe the creative process is different, but I don't think we can minimize the impact that acute marijuana has on the brain.
You know, and our caller, Jonathan, was talking about taking something that's prescribed by a caregiver and it doesn't make him high. And what's interesting to me is we have two different things going on here in Maine. We have a medical marijuana program where people are being treated as though it's a medicine, but we also just legalized recreational marijuana. And it's, which is it? Is marijuana like alcohol, something we take to relax, or is this something we do take to heal?
Well, you know, alcohol has been in our pharmacopoeia as a medication for a long time, but we've kind of advanced into the development of other medications that are more beneficial and have less harm. So I don't think anywhere prescribes alcohol anymore, except maybe for the management of antifreeze poisoning, something like that. You know, I used to work in a hospital where alcohol was still on the formulary to prevent people from going to alcohol withdrawal. So you could order it on the menu so that before surgery, you could have your shot of whiskey so you wouldn't go through alcohol withdrawal while you were waiting for surgery. We just don't have enough evidence. That's the long and the short of it. There's a lot of great anecdotal reports, and we're hearing a lot of them. And I don't doubt that it's been very beneficial for the callers. And I don't doubt that there's callers out there, and we've already heard some who've had bad experiences with cannabis as well. That's why we have to really do structured research to take a look at these things, because there's a lot of bias. If you want to see a good effect from something, you are going to see a good effect. That's kind of like a placebo response in some way, set and setting. And when you're talking about a substance that you know is going to change your mood, your affect, your cognition, and if you have a set and setting and anticipatory effect of what it's going to be, and then it does modify your emotions, it just reinforces that expectation of what you're going to have. And that's actually a challenge with marijuana. It's a challenge for doing good research with it, because you can't have a good placebo to compare it to. Because
people know if they have a placebo.
If they've had it, right?
When I read that this morning research, it kind of made me chuckle. Of course you can't give the placebo.
Well, and going back to we need more research, I said, the argument that people keep making, kids are dying from alcohol as well, and this kind of, well, we already have problems, so let's just throw another problem out there. Why don't we figure it out before we have the problems? Because then it'll be, yeah, well, kids are just dying from marijuana and alcohol. Now we have this new problem. We haven't figured this problem out yet, but people just want to rely on the alcohol problem to answer the problems that haven't even happened yet with this. We don't know what's going to happen when we unleash legal marijuana across the United States, and everyone wants to fall back on the, well, alcohol's a problem too.
Yeah, now we have two. And it's not a fair comparison,
right?
Because so cannabis seems less harmful at this point, but cannabis is also regulated at this point. Alcohol is less regulated. So once cannabis is no longer regulated, we may see that a lot more people are using it and a lot more harms are actually happening.
And
we
you, when you
know.
Say regulated, do you mean the medical marijuana program?
Well, yeah. General access to cannabis. So we do have laws on the books before recreational marijuana passed that you couldn't really possess and shouldn't use it. And some people follow the rules.
And it's still federally illegal. It's right. Still, you know, everyone forgets that in all these arguments. If Trump's new administration wanted to say we're going to actually enforce this, it's done, right? It's everything's done. It's still federally illegal. It's still a Schedule I substance. And as soon as the new any administration wanted to come in and shut it down, they can shut it down.
I'm going to go to Ann, who's calling from Wells. Hi, Ann. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm wondering how marijuana would affect the lungs of someone that has the beginning of COPD. Would that cause it to, you know, get worse? Or, and that's my question.
I could try to take this question. I'm not a pulmonologist, but I think smoking anything is probably a bad idea for COPD or any lung disorder. And cannabis has been shown to cause chronic bronchitis or a chronic cough. And I don't think you would want to get any particulates in your lungs, like ash, soot, and other things. That said, there has not been an association between smoking cannabis and lung cancer, unlike what we really understand about cigarettes. So it doesn't seem like it has the risk of cancer like cigarettes.
Okay, so I think I'm going to squeeze in one more question. This is from Dennis, an email. If THC is effective and without significant side effects, why haven't pharmaceutical companies brought it to the market? Well, working at a major U.S. pharmaceutical firm in the late 1970s, I understood that THC had been taken to clinical trials by that company for glaucoma, hypertension, and to lessen the side effects of chemotherapy. However, reports among some patients of hallucinations resulted in those trials being suspended.
So it is approved. That's what Marinol is, and it's still it's an available medication. It's actually Schedule 3. So we talked about the scheduling. Cannabis, the plant itself, is Schedule 1. But they took THC through the regulatory process, and initially it was Schedule 2, and now it's Schedule 3, and it's for nausea associated with chemotherapy and wasting with HIV/AIDS. And so it is available, and it is actually, I think it's only brand name that you can take.
And the Sativex and those types of, I think it's GW Pharma. I could be mistaken, but there it is being tested by a company in the United States. And I don't know if it's Sativex and there's or another new product of the same concept, isolated cannabinoids, right? Not the whole pot plant, but an isolated cannabinoids for indicated conditions.
All right. Well, this is a really interesting conversation, but unfortunately we're out of time. Kristen Teeter, Associate Professor of Psychopharmacology at the University of New England College of Pharmacy, and Dr. Jonathan Fellers, Director of the Integrated Medication-Assisted Treatment Program at Maine Medical Center. John Keimel ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, join host Keith Shortall and our team of political analysts to talk about Governor LePage's State of the State address, which airs tonight at 7 here on Maine Public. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling.